Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to a special post-election no sleep till results are fully in podcast version from us. I'll be honest with you, it's just going to be sort of 30 minutes of us kind of laughing hysterically, but do stay tuned for that. Woohoo! Welcome to a New Statesman special post-election podcast. I've had 3 hours sleep. Stephen, you've had 0 hours sleep, right?
No, I've literally been awake since 7 o'clock yesterday morning. 6:30 when I woke up to send my morning email, which you should subscribe to. It's now past six. I've been awake for 24 hours.
Yeah. Do you know what I just keep thinking of? You know that great track, Congratulations, on the Hamilton mixtape?
Yeah.
I just keep thinking, like, congratulations on inventing a new kind of stupid. Open all the cages at the zoo, kind of stupid. Calling an election you didn't have to do, kind of stupid. That's kind of sums up my mood this morning.
I mean, I'm so happy. this is the happiest I've been since my wedding day. I'm so happy.
Do you know why I'm particularly happy? I have been thinking about this. Because I have to say, my initial reaction, and one that has persisted throughout the last 12 hours, is just finding it profoundly, profoundly funny. I mean, it is just inherently comic. It also makes me sort of weirdly proud to be British, in that someone goes, anoint me your supreme overlord. And everyone goes, actually. It's a really great tale of kind of hubris and nemesis. But also it has, I think, really interesting implications for Brexit, which is something that I care really deeply about. You know, after that vote last year, people were saying that 52% mandate was a mandate for the hardest form of Brexit. You know, it was a vindication of incredibly right-wing values. And actually, guess what? This is one of the reasons that lots of people are opposed to referendums. People's views are nuanced, sometimes contradictory, and they're not as simple as that binary choice would suggest. I mean, we're all being railroaded in one direction.
Yeah, so I mean, so there are dozens of reasons for my glee. I suppose, obviously, the first and the biggest one is, and it turns out there is significantly more life in the left in general and the Labour Party in particular than I had feared, and there's more viability to that as an approach to winning power. So that's one reason to be cheerful. The second is a woman who I increasingly regard as not just having the wrong ideologies, but actually being just not fit to hold the office of Prime Minister, is going to be weakened, probably fatally. It may take a few years for the wounds that she has sustained in this election to overcome her. But someone who I have been deeply troubled through her premiership, the way she has run roughshod over Purdah, she's run roughshod over kind of just the kind of some. There have just been a casualness around democratic norms, and that golden thread in that manifesto of tweaks to the election rules that they believe will advantage them. I just think it's very good that the central driver behind that is hold below the waterline.
And also, I think they will have to make a lot more compromises on Brexit legislation. I also think grammar schools are facing a pretty shaky future this morning.
Well, yeah, I mean, the interesting thing that what someone asked me on Twitter that I didn't know the answer to, and I still don't know the answer to, because all of the people I would ask are asleep, but I'm intrigued by it, is what I don't know what that really does to manifesto commitments. Like, you can't really be like, oh, Salisbury, so
Salisbury. But didn't get a majority. You have to strive towards them. But I think it's probably recognised that one is allowed to discreetly never bring that piece of legislation. The other thing I think is an interesting change from Cameron's dynamic is that she doesn't have, particularly the way that George Osborne built up a faction of patronage around him, right? So there was a persistent thing that was grumpiness by the end of Cameron's tenure about the fact that, you know, Eurosceptic usual suspects were very rebellious. And actually, what kind of, you know, what benefit accrued to you from being a loyal, centrist kind of Remain Cameroon? And actually, the trouble with May is that she doesn't have a faction, right? I mean, she's going to face an incredibly, I would say, probably incredibly rebellious party because there's no one who's got any personal loyalty to her.
And also, they're furious. The average Conservative MP does regard a Corbyn-led government as a dangerous prospect, right? There'll be many, many consequences to this election. I think it forces a lot of people, including me, to rethink many of our assumptions about why people vote the way they do. But for a lot of those people, they think that basically they teetered into what they would see as a dangerous scenario through her incompetence and her blunders. Secondly, a lot of their friends have lost their jobs, right? And people don't take kindly to that. Some of them have come very close to losing their jobs, and people come even less kindly to that. So,
well, that's how I feel generally about the election, actually, is that, you know, it's quite a humbling experience because we didn't see it coming. You know, all the polls by the end of the year, you've had them on 7 points ahead, apart from that YouGov model that we all went, oh, YouGov be trolling. And I feel like, okay, this is a time where I just need to go and kind of think about stuff and look into the data. But it's really interesting. There's so many weird new data points that I didn't expect. So the SNP, to sledge that quickly, I think is really extraordinary.
So the SNP is the thing I'm trying not to think too much about because it's the one thing I did think would happen and feel was quite confident in. And I always think the danger when you get most things wrong is you kind of cling on to the thing. We're like, oh, I thought that was a thing. We saw in 2016 that people were getting more effective at voting against the SNP and working out how to defeat the SNP. So actually, well, I think there are a couple of there are two strategic decisions of Jeremy Corbyn's that I think were validated by the
one surely
result.
Being Article 50.
One, yeah, Article 50.
And I think that's a really fascinating thing, actually, because I was thinking about this morning, about the fact that from the Labour MPs that I talked to, they were saying, actually, immigration's really not coming up that much on the doorstep, because there is an assumption that as Brexit proceeds, we'll leave the single market, we'll end freedom of movement, and that will be sorted. And that was something that crippled Ed Miliband. And actually, you've had a fascinating situation where kind of liberal city types have accepted a more draconian immigration policy than Ed Miliband could have got away with. But because Jeremy Corbyn is the kind of guarantor of their values, they're kind of okay with that.
Yeah, but I also think, I mean, because there was one of the big problems under New Labour was that the way that successive Home Secretaries would get around the fact that they couldn't control free movement was to introduce more and more cruelty into the system where we could control immigration. And I think the average person who cares about immigration issues knows that a migration system overseen by Diane Abbott would be more humane than the one we have now. The second correct decision, which I'm hoping I'm going to remember because I'm quite tired, but the first decision, Article 50, okay, it's also a no-brainer because he's a Eurosceptic of long vintage, but actually, just because your tactical call is easy for you doesn't mean that you weren't right.
And he went against a big feeling of swelling of sentiment in the PLP about that, and actually several MPs who felt they had to vote the other way,
including
their constituencies.
And it properly,
including Clive Lewis.
Yeah, and it is the only issue which has properly split him for both his base in the membership and his allies in the PLP. So you know.
So what's his second great call?
The second correct call. I think it feels very clear to me just from the text and messages I've received throughout the day and also throughout the night that the advantage that the Scottish Labour Party has is they are the most acceptable tactical vote against the SNP. They have ended up in sort of the right place, right? They are.
Well, that's fascinating because, I mean, you know, Kezia Dugdale, who I've always, you know, I think personally is a very, very likeable politician, has been battered by people saying, oh, your triangulation on a second referendum will kind of completely cost you. The Tories will end up with all the pro-union votes in Scotland, you know, and Labour will be completely squeezed out of the picture. And that's something that I thought would happen as well, given that the SNP are a party of the centre-left. And that doesn't seem to have stopped Labour picking up, you know, Kirkcaldy, Gordon Brownsville seat, which once was, I think, the biggest majority in the Commons. has now gone back to Labour again.
But yeah, I think the main cause for glee, and apologies to those of you who have taken the sensible and life stretching decision to subscribe to my free morning email, because you may have read this already by now, but the thing it's really important, and I think a lot of people did not understand about this election, and this is again one of the things I did keep saying, it was basically impossible to imagine someone winning the election after the 2015 election, because although the majority was small, the situation in the marginals was so bad. You had so many sort of notional marginals with 10,000 Tories. The map that Ed Miliband passed on to his successor was appalling. The map that Jeremy Corbyn has created, right, is much more congenial to anyone contemplating getting the Conservatives out of power. In my view, he's clearly, and clearly the view of the MPs I've spoken to this morning, he's clearly earned the right, if he wishes to lead Labour into the 2022
Another very
election.
Nice thing I think that has happened is, I think it is a big black mark against that Linton-Crosby-style campaign, where you just have some relentlessly negative messaging and one slogan that you keep pummeling over and over again.
He now has basically a record of having won one election outside of Australia. He can't win reliably somewhere where you have to get people to vote for you.
Yeah, and I mean, we said this all the way through the campaign, but you know, Jeremy Corbyn ran a much better campaign. It was a positive campaign. It said uplifting things, it inspired people, and Theresa May ran a relentlessly negative campaign where she was either absent, just refusing to turn up to stuff at all, or saying, you know, these people are terrifying, be terrified. And I think that also kind of gives me hope for the future, that it's, you know, that people will be sceptical about the value of just going for the full kind of, you know, baseball bat approach, basically.
And the other hugely positive thing, right, is that all of the evidence, right, and I could see this in my own community, right? People who had voted for the first time in the European referendum had got posters for not always Labour, and in some cases the Animal Welfare Party or whatever, but they'd clearly been politicised by the referendum, and another group of people have clearly been politicised by Jeremy Corbyn. So I actually think it is likely that this spike in youth turnout, I don't think it is going to go away.
Yeah, I think it must be real for a start, because actually the thing that's fascinating is, I mean, you talk to people on the doorsteps as well. It was tough to pick this up on the doorsteps. And actually, when we were talking to Labour MPs in the last couple of days, none of them were saying, oh my God, everybody I go and talk to loves Jeremy Corbyn. This is totally not what I was expecting.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why people didn't hear it is it's fairly clear from polling and from the YouGov model, which was hugely validated. We were testing it against the actual results throughout the night, and they held up very well. Is the Labour's coalition is quite heavy on women, and it's quite light on men of the kind we saw shouting in the final debate thing about, you know, Jeremy, why won't you immolate people? Now, the thing is if you are a canvasser or an MP and a large man shouts at you, obviously that is a bigger part of your campaigning experience.
And a large man in his 60s is more likely to be home at the time when you're trying to canvass, right? And not to live in a shared flat or, you know,
yeah,
those
that seems
things
like, you know, shared flats, more likely to be working on social hours, more likely to be out for social reasons, more likely to live in flats with entry phones. Young voters are harder to canvass, right? So there are, and also if you're actually canvassing a scary shouty man and then a softly spoken ethnic minority graduate woman, which obviously is not a real, that is actually the kind of aggregate Labour voter.
This is what I think is fascinating, is we talked for a long time, you know, various things about, like, the how do you unite the wine drinkers and the beer drinkers and all this kind of stuff. And what Jeremy Corbyn does seem to have done is kept all of his liberal metropolitan voters on side, whilst also having a significant offer to places like, you know, they came very close in Hastings, for example, of unseating Amber Rudd, right? Kensington is now in it's, I think, third recount or something like that. Portsmouth, one of the Portsmouth seats, right, has gone Labour. What's the other one? Canterbury, which I think hasn't been Labour in 200 years or something.
I mean, literally, never been Labour. Literally, the last time the Tories lost it, they lost it to William Gladstone's Liberals. Right. I mean, it's such a good result. But the other thing,
and some of the swings in Scotland were incredible. You know, 9% swings. I mean, that is some frothy, given some of the swings we saw in 2015 in Scotland. Those are some voters who are really willing to change their mind.
But I think the other thing that is really exciting about it is I don't think that any party will ever feel relaxed about going into an election offering as thin gruel to young working age voters and as the Conservatives have.
Yes.
And I think the thing is, I think the interesting thing is this does massively change the political incentive over housing, right? If the Conservatives go into the next election and they have like a really good housing offer for the sort of top 50% of the young, right? That is depressing because I would prefer a housing offer for 100% of the young, but that is still a fundamental change in politics forever and for the good.
Yeah, no, they must be very, very worried that actually, if this youth surge does turn out to be, then, you know, they've always said that buying a house, owning a house was one of the big things that sort of made you turn conservative. You had a sort of sense of kind of stability in your life. And there is a generation that has been kind of failed on that promise, that for whom, you know, they probably have a really good disposable income, a generation of young professionals that actually they live pretty well, but there is no amount of money that they could save. And they're pretty tired of all those articles saying like, have a few fewer avocado brunches and you could buy a house, because you're like, okay, that's about £4. And the deposit on a house in London, you know, for an average house, if you're looking at 20% deposit on an average house price in London, is over £100,000.
That's a lot of toast. There were also lots of just individually affirming results.
You know, like, Ian Duncan Smith came very close. That would have been the cherry on my cake of delight.
I mean, Ian Duncan Smith getting a fright, that was pretty good. Peter Kyle not just defeating, you know, some kind of dodgy faith, maybe the gay should be healed person, but crushing her. I mean, just literally using her vote as a chew toy. I mean, that was brilliant.
Jess Phillips has ended up with a whacking great majority and actually put John Hemming, the Liberal Democrat, who ran a pretty nasty campaign that was basically like, look at this tart, she's always on the telly, she's not serving you lads, into third place, which is another
astonishing result. Diana winning with more votes. Her majority is almost as big as Theresa May's total votes.
If I were Diana, I'd probably allow myself maybe like a great Instagram or like just a great, I don't know, great picture of my smiling face emailed to Theresa May. Like, Thangham Debonair has ended up with a majority of 37,000 in Bristol West.
Yeah, I mean,
37,000. And that's somebody who's had a tough time. She had breast cancer almost immediately after she joined the Commons and actually had to kind of stay in touch and couldn't come into Westminster for a long time. So she's somebody who's worked through really difficult personal circumstances. I think that's quite a heartening result.
Yeah, and Caroline Lucas winning wise. And yeah, and actually the Liberal Democrats who...
Oh, Nick, can we have a moment to say Nick Clegg's face... I mean, if you didn't find that upsetting, then you have no heart, Stephen. Because
it was sad.
He looked so genuinely crushed. And he gave a really great speech that actually was about the young.
I think, yeah, it was sad. Yeah, he has an immense understanding of the European Union, which we are very badly going to need in the coming...
Someone tweeted, I think he's going to end up doing European Union negotiations for the other side. Like, no, Nick Clegg. We should probably, because we're going to be talking forever.
The final point we should make about the Lib Dems, though, is, right, is although I can see how it probably seems to most of our Lib Dem listeners like they had an awful night, because of
losing Clegg is a huge
blur. The loss of Clegg, the galling spectacle of Zach Goldsmith slouching
slithering back
into Parliament.
Tim
Farron having a recount. But actually, the Liberal Democrats are larger and stronger than they were.
And in Joe Swinson, they've got somebody who is both very well-liked within the party, you know, somebody who is really bedded into the structures. Duncan Hame, her husband, used to also be a Lib Dem MP. They were, as a couple, they were really solidly well-liked. And I think if you're thinking about the kind of long-term future of the Democrats, that is a good direction for them to have gone in. Vince Cable, for all that he might have some, he doesn't underestimate his own intellect and importance. That's another really great, solid person that they've got back on the bench on that, particularly now that Brexit is happening.
And also in general, kind of away from the Lib Dems, the exciting thing about this, right, is that the alternatives to the Labour Party, Spring the Party, Women's Equality Party, you know, these other sort of like...
You haven't even mentioned Philip Davis losing.
No, he didn't lose in the end.
Oh, what? Oh, no, I went to bed and he'd still lost. Oh, what? That is bad. That is bad. You've harshed my mellow, Stephen.
Wow, so this was a kind of dark ending to the NS.
No, because it's good, because, Preet Gill, for example, got in Birmingham, Edgbaston, Gisela Stewart's seat, so she's the first Sikh woman.
Nick Timothy, the supposed architect of Erdington conservatism, couldn't even win Erdington, Nick. How do you like me now?
That's Jack Dromey's seat, right? So the Harman menage is pretty happy this morning. And Vicky Foxcroft got back in my seat in Lewisham, Deptford, where actually their son is a councillor. So it was probably for the Dromeymans, that was a pretty tasty evening. There was another result that I thought was fascinating as well. But do you know what? My brain is now cooked. I'm now going to go and try and do a load of TV and probably just witter to myself and trail off. No! Let's talk about what happens next, because I think the trouble is now we've moved from the sunlit uplands of that was actually just really very funny. I think that a Conservative coalition with the DUP, which is, or Supply and Confidence, whatever it ends up being, whilst admittedly initially hilarious, because that will be literally a coalition of chaos.
It also does literally mean Jeremy has already ended austerity in one part of the United Kingdom. I mean, like,
those money taps, like,
the magic money tree is going to be planting all over Northern Ireland.
And I think that's a fascinating thing, because actually I think that long term that might be a problem for English voters with the Conservatives, because the problem is exactly the same problem with the SNP propping up Labour, right? Is that people will think, well, hang on a minute, they're going to end up getting loads more money than us. Although, luckily, I think there's a slightly different thing in that not a lot of news escapes Northern Ireland, so yeah. We probably just won't hear about it.
I mean, to do that awful journalist thing of complaining about the journalists, I did think the BBC's election night coverage was otherwise very good, but at the point when it became apparent that Northern Ireland was going to be very important,
they didn't really seem to have a lot of thoughts about it. I thought Patrick McGuire, who put in a sterling performance last night and has become 90% more Scouse with happiness.
I mean, I will always be grateful to the Labour Party and to Jeremy Corbyn for the spectacle of Patrick running in, punching the air, literally punching the air, and then like sliding onto his knees. I mean, that and Anna Soubry's just demolition of Theresa May.
She held her seat. That's another one I missed out.
So she held her seat, and then like she goes on, kind of, but she goes on. She's like obviously clearly quite upset because some of her friends have lost her seat. Yeah. Dimbleby's like, what do you think? She's like, the campaign was dreadful. And he's like, you say it was dreadful. She's like, well, where do you start? And then just start in this like both clearly really upset but incredibly controlled manner, just being like, Theresa always takes responsibility, and I'm sure she will. I think it is going to be one of the TV moments that we look back on when we look back on great election moments. It was fantastic.
Oh, I'm really excited. I mean, we'll go and hunt that out when we finish recording this. Ben Bradshaw, my parents-in-law's MP, not only hung on in Exeter, right?
He hung on, he's like built a freaking like maisonette in one of the crevices he was hanging on. I mean, another sort of thumpingly good result. It does show that the appeal and survivability of an unapologetically left-wing platform is more extensive than we thought.
Yeah, I think that will be the thing, is whoever comes next, then they're not going to go back to... They're just not going to feel the need that they have to...
Well, the interest... Yeah, the
tack back to the centre.
The interesting question is obviously Jeremy now has a very clear, just an unarguable right, in my view, to lead Labour into the next election. He's gained both votes and seats, which to my mind, this election result was literally the best possible scenario after the awful 2015 result. So he has more than exceeded the
requirement. I think everybody's very quiet this morning. I think there was a feeling that it's possible, if they'd driven up vote share but not seats, there would be an almighty bun fight about whether or not that constituted a victory. And all of those questions have been answered by the fact that they are just in a much better position on all possible measures.
There's quite an important but, though, which is that there are more left-leaning, left-wing MPs than there were...
Is this ballot time? Are we already talking about ballot time?
Well, so basically, if Jeremy doesn't want to stay, he doesn't have to stay...
Because
their fear has always been that he steps down and then Tom like gets out his ice pick and starts running around hitting them all.
Harsh your mellow for a minute and say the other thing is I think that the DUP are a very conservative party, right? This is not a great election for women in the sense that there are for the first time more than 200 female MPs returned to the Commons. But I think that in order to make concessions to a party that's still heavily influenced by religion, and social conservatism is not going to make. I mean, Theresa May's Downing Street speech about all the happy, lovely living times together. I don't think that there's going to be a relaxation of their social liberalism if the DUP have any say in the matter whatsoever.
Oh no, I mean, this will be a more right wing and traditionally conservative government, but it also is much weaker. And I think, and maybe this is one of those things. Obviously, I'm of that generation for which the last Labour government felt like it was forever, and then in recent times has felt like it would be never, right? And so, yes, it's a more traditional, but it's also much weaker. I just think, yeah, what I'm excited about is I feel the first time of this morning, I feel I can imagine the end of the Conservative government.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that was the thing. It was just like, well, how, you know, this massive yellow block in Scotland, and then, you know, your seats with a 10,000 majority in England and Wales. And it turns out, actually,
well, this thing is like,
actually, Labour can take they seats are, with a 10,000 majority.
They are, yeah, it shows that. They don't need to go, oh, God, how can we possibly, you know, win. I mean, they may win Kensington, Harlow, Bradley, Filton, Chingford and Wood Green, they came very close to. Chipping Barnet. Literally, she held on by 381 votes.
My concern about that, and then maybe I'm being too early to be this bad, is that I think next time the dynamic of the campaign will be different, because there was a lot of focus, particularly by Labour canvassers, on if you have any concerns about Jeremy Corbyn, don't worry, because he can't be Prime Minister, because that was the narrative. And I think that I just wonder if we're being a bit cruel in retrospect to Ed Miliband about the fact that he fought an election in which the premise was that people were looking at a potential prime minister, and therefore everything was kind of judged through that prism. Whereas I wonder if we got quite the same approach this time when we were looking at who we're going to be elect as an opposition.
I think
that's not to take away from Jeremy Corbyn's victory. And I would say it is Jeremy Corbyn's victory, because I think it was a very presidential style contest. And undoubtedly, he was the Labour figure that people saw most of.
I think that was, yeah. And definitely, you know, there wasn't I didn't encounter the fear of Corbyn than there was a fear of Ed Miliband. I mean, I think in some ways they were helped because they weren't being shifty about things. We all knew the Eds were going to tax a bit more, but they kind of were kind of like, oh, you know, mumble, mumble, which kind of meant everyone was like, oh, so I'm up for grabs. So I think there were other reasons why the fear was not there. I think it will be more difficult because Jeremy Corbyn was already held to a much higher policy standard by most of the press than the Conservatives were, and that was when they didn't think he would win, right? We know that the bar for a Labour Party to do anything is much higher, and that won't change. However,
in electoral terms, if you say, I'm going to have to take Ed Miliband's press and Ed Miliband's map versus I'm going to take Jeremy Corbyn's press and Jeremy Corbyn's map, you take
Yeah, I think it's just in every way it's a better state for the Labour Party. And I also just think having significantly underestimated what Corbynism could achieve now, I just kind of feel like the case has to be one for an optimistic view of what it could achieve. To be honest, I hope to God in many ways from a world perspective as soon as possible. I hope from a I haven't been asleep now for some time perspective then this government lasts a long time. But I'm sure it's six months
before we have the next election, if I'm brutally honest with you. I just need a bit of... But no Labour leadership election this summer. Who knows? But I wouldn't say necessarily a Lib Dem leadership election.
No, I think for them, that is actually, I think, the one element of this which is not great, which is that I don't think that you could fairly say Tim Farron has distinguished himself on the campaign trail. However, it is a good result, so it's a bit...
There's no urgency to kicking him out, right? Yeah. If you assume that Theresa May is not voluntarily going to call another election to increase her majority.
Oh, it's so brilliant. And the other fun thing, of course, will be them coming for Theresa May.
Do you know what I do love a good bit of blue on blue, right? It is kind of alien versus predator. You can just relax and enjoy the sheer kind of saltiness of it because you have no investment whatsoever in the outcome. I also think they're probably about to make a catastrophic mistake if they think that reaching for Boris Johnson is going to help them in those seats. I think Boris has had, we've had to talk about this before, an abysmal campaign in which his bonhomie is completely rubbed off and he just looks a bit shifty and unpleasant.
I do think, and again, this is... could be wrong, but I think it's possible to overread the fact that ultimately the government chose to go for an election when people's real-term wages were falling because of inflation and the fall in the pound. And then you had an opposition going, look, it doesn't need to be like this. Here's some hope.
Yeah, we can have a different kind of society. Kind of, we can build an NHS that works for everybody.
Kind of, and in some ways...
Some people have to pay a bit more. I mean, that's the best thing, is they went into an election promising to put some people's taxes up, right? And which is... I have a You Ask Us to finish, Stephen. It's from Helen in London. And it's, is it still funny that Theresa May called an election to get a bigger majority and ended up without one at all?
It will never not be funny.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a sensational vindication of Jeremy Corbyn's two leadership wins, neither of which I voted for, but big the man up.
And we bring you some podcast extras filmed live at the New Statesman podcast, which I had last night at the OXO Tower. It's fair to say that that was a great atmosphere in which to see the exit poll. I think there was just sort of 5 minutes of uninterrupted screaming. But we talked to some of our guests there, and you're going to hear from them now.
Yeah, my name is Ian Hislop. Well, I'm at the New Statesman Party and I'm listening to the screams, which suggests it's quite exciting. If the exit poll is right, and there's lots of people here who are not sure it is, but if it is, that's just extraordinary. As usual, everyone wrong about everything. Fantastic.
I'm Peter Wilby. I'm a former editor of the New Statesman, and I still write a weekly column for the New Statesman. First of all, it's very surprising because I'm an optimist. I was an optimist, but compared with most people, about the result of the election, I was forecasting a Conservative majority of less than 60, and I thought it would be around about 40 to 50. I certainly did not expect a hung parliament or anything anywhere near a hung parliament. So if this result is correct, it falls into the category of sensational. It's amazing if it's true. But what it shows, what it would show is the British people, the British voters, are completely fed up with the political establishment in any form. They're fed up with people in London telling them how to vote, telling them how to think, telling them how they are going to vote, telling them anything. And if they're told you are about to deliver to Theresa May, whoever it is, a landslide, they will all decide they're going to do the opposite. That's what I think is going on.
My name is Jess Bremer. I'm the deputy editor of Newsnight. Well, the exit poll is extraordinary, and the sense of shock in the room was palpable. I can't pretend that anybody expected that, although I'd sort of joked in the office that it might end up being a hung parliament. To be honest, I didn't believe it. So let's see whether the exit poll is right, I guess.
George Eaton, political editor here. A surprise result. Most forecasters were predicting a Tory majority, but not a shock one. Other pollsters were saying this was possible, and early elections do have a habit of backfiring on prime ministers, and this has blown up badly in Theresa May's face. She has not got the victory that she hoped for, and her authority is badly weakened. And this result has come not in spite of the campaign she's run, but because of it. She became the first prime minister to U-turn on a manifesto policy during her campaign, the now infamous dementia tax. The manifesto lacks any attention-grabbing, attractive offer to knock that off the front pages. And Britain, on the eve of its most complex post-war negotiation in the form of Brexit, is now left with perhaps the most chaotic election result possible.
I'm Chris Murray, I'm a Labour activist. I was out on the doorstep today in Wolverhampton, and I heard core Labour voters, for example, McDonald's workers, NHS workers, primary school teachers, telling me that they would not support the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, and that is in a safe Labour seat where the Tories have not made inroads since the 70s. Now, if this exit poll is right, that means a significant thing has happened where core Labour voters have switched or stayed at home and other voters have turned out. And that is a potentially seismic change in British politics.
Hi, my name's Barbara Speed and I worked at the New Statesman until about a year ago. I did the interview with Jeremy Corbyn for the New Statesman when he first stood for the leadership election after the last election, and nobody knew who he was. The headline on our piece was something like, Labour leadership candidate Jeremy Corbyn MP, because everyone said that no one would know who he was. And we just had the exit poll for this election in which he's massively exceeded anybody's expectations, including mine, I have to say. But I am extremely happy. I think that he has started, he's come in a massive way since then.
Tom Kibasi, Director of the Institute for Public Policy Research. Well, I think this evening, maybe June, we'll see the end of May, and the public seem to have concluded that none of the candidates deserve to be Prime Minister. And if that's the case, it presents a period of significant political instability for the UK.
I'm Elaine Moore, and I'm a journalist at the Financial Times.
I'm Shahid Bari. I'm a lecturer and a broadcaster for the BBC.
I was very surprised. I think we were both very surprised by the exit polls.
I had little flowers of hope budding in my heart all day, but people have been resolutely trampling all over them. So when the exit poll came in, I was just absolutely bewildered. I'm trying not to get too hopeful. I don't really know what it means. I'm scared that it might mean that Boris Johnson is about to become the Prime Minister.
Do you hear the people singing the song of angry men? Thank you for listening to this podcast from the New Statesman. It's produced by India Bork and it's mixed by James Shield. Did I mention I have a morning email?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.